Thank you. Yeah, so the way that I like to do these things is really as interactive as you want. So I'll pause at certain times to let you ask. But even if I say something that doesn't seem clear or that requires some more explanation, feel free to interrupt at any time so that we are... Because what I'm going to do, I was talking with Anton about what would be useful. And so what I'm going to do is to try to take you through the development of the theory from the beginning. Because a lot of what I've done lately is try to reflect on what is this thing about? What is this theory trying to do? So I'm going to go take you through my own reflection on what the enterprise was and how it has transformed over time. Because, I don't live in a university. And so, as a theorist, a lot of the field in which I develop theory is actually practice. So I work with organizations in different contexts where they are interested in putting these ideas into practice. And so the theory gets tested to the extent that it helps people make sense of what they are trying to do. It's a different way of developing theory, but I think it's legitimate because in the social sciences, the purpose of a theory is really to help people look at the world in a specific way and ask specific questions about the world. And that is true if you are a researcher and you have a body of data that you need to interpret for your PhD or for something or for a project. But it is also true if you are in practice and you have a learning problem and you have to make sense of the problem and try to think of solutions. So there also theory can be useful, and it's also a place where theory gets tested for its usefulness. So, you know, when people say, well, what is the status of a theory like committees of practice? Well, it's not a theory that's true or false in the same way that a statement about the universe is true or false. It's more, is this a useful way of looking at the world, and does it make you focus on aspects of the human experience that are useful for your purpose? And so for you doing research here in this institution or being teachers in this institution, I would invite you, as I talk, to think about, is this a useful way to look at the kind of challenges that I have, or to look at the data that I'm collecting? And does it enable me to tell an interesting story about the human experience of learning? So I'm going to just go almost biographically, historically, through the development of this theory. So I started my research work at an institute in California called the Institute for Research on Learning. And that institute was started by the Xerox Foundation, actually outside of a university. It was an academic research institute, but in those days, interdisciplinary work was not very valued in universities, so they started an institute outside of a university context to bring together scholars from different disciplines. The charter was to rethink learning. And the idea was that the educational system was running into trouble, and that somebody ought to rethink what assumptions about learning are we making such that we have the institutions that we have. So that was the idea of this institute, bringing together people from different disciplines. I was coming from artificial intelligence, cognitive science. There were others coming from anthropology, coming from psychology, coming from the teaching of different disciplines like physics education or math education and language education. There were some linguists. Different people from different perspective to debate and think about the assumptions that we're making about learning. And so I started to work with an anthropologist that you mentioned, Jean Lave, and she had been doing studies of apprenticeship in Western Africa, apprenticeship among tailors. And so we were looking at apprenticeship in different places around the world. And what we saw is that, in fact, even though apprenticeship is often a concept, is often conceptualized as a relationship between a master and a student, in fact, if you look at actual cases of apprenticeship, what you find is that a lot of the learning relationship are not directly with the master. The master is often a, you know, too imposing a figure for a young apprentice to go with a question. So you go to another apprentice who is a bit ahead of you when you have a problem. And so that this notion of committee of practice was born out of our need to give a name to this living curriculum that we saw in these different cases of apprenticeship, and we called that a community of practice. So it was a very simple, humble birth, really, for a concept that has, you know, taking me through my career, basically. but we just needed a name for this living curriculum. And so, oh, sorry, this was supposed to stay here. Yeah. And so, in this first phase of the theory, if you will, we really very much theorized learning as a journey into a community. Because what we saw is that apprentices went through a kind of journey with more or less formal rituals of recognition of membership. Okay? So if you are a young tailor apprentice, you start at the boundary, at the periphery of the community, doing little things like to run errands, to go buy some threads when people need thread and so on and so forth. And there are ways that you are recognized increasingly as a member of the community. Maybe you are given the task of sewing a button, which is a peripheral task, not too dangerous. If you make a mistake, it can be corrected easily, you know. And then one day maybe you are asked to cut the fabric, you know, and that's a very central task. It's very costly if you make a mistake, and it shows that you really understand the practice, because in order to know how to cut the fabric properly, you have to understand all the stages that the fabric is going to go through to become a jacket, you know. So having walked through the different stages of the production process, if you will, you are then ready to be recognized as a full member. So very much a journey into full membership. And there are a number of things that were significant for us as theorists that we're observing. One of them is very much how meaning in practice, the negotiation of meaning in practice, was driving the learning. So As a young apprentice, you had a lot of interaction with the community, with what it meant to be a tailor, what people did. You see what I mean? You had a solid picture of that practice as a practice before you even learned the technicality of things. You know, and to us that was a really important way of thinking, especially because, you know, at that time, we thought our main audience would be people in education and people in schools. We think, huh, it's interesting that in school it's almost like we have reversed that, you know? It's like, you know, maybe to learn how to do this long division is meaningless to you now, but trust me, when you grow up, you will thank me. So, you know, it's meaningless now, but don't worry, you know? It will be meaningful for you later. You see what I mean? So it's almost like we have put meaning behind learning instead of in front of learning. So it was an interesting observation, you know, if we compared. And by the way, I just wanted to make clear that even then we were aware that we were not going to sort of like bring back apprenticeship, you know. We were just saying, what can we learn in this age-old system? Because apprenticeship has been, you know, with humankind forever. So what can we learn from this age-old system about learning in general that we can apply then to different contexts, whether or not there is a system of apprenticeship. Okay? But this centrality of meaning as a driver of learning, as opposed to meaning as a kind of tail of learning, was an important one. The other one is the importance of the practice, of the social practice, and the understanding of the practice as a context for giving meaning to what people were doing. The fact that this practice was the property of a community, and therefore a very socially embedded system, and that also gave us a sense of the complexity of knowing in the world, right? That a community is a complex social system, and if practice and knowing in practice is a property of that community, then knowing in practice is complicated, you know? And again, this idea that in school you can extract knowledge from practice, serve knowledge as a curriculum, and then go forth and apply, was like, but this is removing an important complexity of knowing from the experience of knowing. And, you know, and then there's, of course, this whole question of transfer. How does knowledge from school transfer into practice? But it's been extracted from practice to start with. So it set up all sorts of questions about the role of institution of learning in the organization of knowing in society more generally. And the last one that was really that I really wanted to bring up, that was striking for us at the time, is how much learning was a transformation of the person. So learning was not just acquiring certain skills, but it was also fundamentally a transformation of who you were. You were becoming a certain kind of person, and so you were learning to be a practitioner and not simply learning a practice. And to us that was a really important observation, because the whole question of identity is of course something that in many schooling contexts is almost set to the side, you know. It's almost like, and when you think about it, for us something that became interesting about the community of practice is that it's a system of learning where the system offers you both a certain number of techniques, but also a chance to become the person for whom those techniques were a meaningful way of being in the world. So for us, this notion of meaningfulness, when it is embedded in that system, comes down to who am I becoming, and how does that then give me a way to be in the world such that what I'm learning is actually something that I can manifest, you know. So I'm going to pause here because I just wanted to give you a quick summary of this first phase of the theory. If you have any question, stories, otherwise I can continue, but... Yeah.
Wait a minute, Anna. I will use the microphone so you can. Thank
you very much. It was very interesting, but I wonder if you can give an example of the last thing you said about the connection between meaning and practice and the meaningful way of being in the world through learning, and if it applies to just a specific educational context, or it is like life skills in general?
Well, I mean, we would say that it is a much more generalized observation than in this specific context. That in fact, learning to become is as much what learning is about than learning to do or to acquire some pieces of information. And I think we would say this is very general. And now we would say that an educational system that does not serve that, does not recognize that, will run into trouble, because it will be perceived as irrelevant for people who are themselves on a trajectory. You see what I mean? So, it manifests. I'm not sure this is a good example, but it triggers an example of a group of engineers in an organization. They were system engineers. And they had a very animated discussion. Well, no, maybe that doesn't answer your question. But anyway, I'll finish the story now I've started. they had an animated discussion about how to keep your marriage alive when you have to be on a plane 5 days a week, because those were system engineers who had to work at the client's location, right? I think what it shows is that the practice is also serving, how can you be a person who can do that? You see what I mean? It's not simply saying these are the techniques, but this is the kind of person you have to be in the world. It takes the whole person into account, the whole person as a knowing entity, as opposed to simply a small slice of the person, you know? And so, if you think of schooling, for instance, right? One of the problem that we would see in schooling from this perspective is that you are asked to be a very small slice of who you are. You see what I mean? There are lots of aspects of your life that are not expressible in that context. And so, from this perspective, the problem of transfer, for instance, would also be related to issues of identity, right? That if you are not allowed to be who you are in a certain context, then no wonder this has difficulty transferring somewhere else, because it's such a small slice, like being able to answer the question of the teacher and so on. It's a very small slice of who you are. Does it? I don't know if that makes sense. But for us, it's a very, because of course there are cognitive aspects to transfer, you know, and I'm not denying that. But from a cognitive aspect to transfer, people tend to say you have to generalize. The way you transfer is to explicitly generalize, so that you can then re-embed, you know. Here is a theory that proposes a bit of a different explanatory framework for transfer. We're saying, if your identity is squeezed in a certain context, chances are what you learn there is not going to transfer very easily to other aspects, because you were a very small part of who you are, or something like that. You see what I'm saying? So it's a different explanatory framework, and it's not that one is at the exclusion of the other, but it's certainly presenting a different set of perspective and questions about the whole problem of knowledge transfer. Because some people, by the way, I think that's important. At the time we were talking about situated learning when we presented those theories. It's a term that I don't use very much anymore, because very often situated learning assume that things don't transfer. No? If you look at identity and the construction of the person, then things do transfer, because who we are is not something that we forget. You see what I mean? We have a memory, and so we keep being who we are across different contexts. So from this perspective, transfer should be unproblematic. From this perspective, transfer should happen all the time, you know? But I think it really depends on how much of your identity is expressible in a certain context. Yes?
Thanks. Thanks for this opportunity to ask you questions.
Yeah, yeah.
I was wondering whether you could put, instead of social, you could put biological or neurophysiological or neuropsychological theory of learning.
So,
because as I see your theory development, I see that it it corresponds very well with new neuro or brain research, and the way in which mammals, not just humans, cooperate and correspond with each other and the environment.
Okay, so. I would never be able to do that because I'm not a neurobiologist, okay? I am very happy. I'm very happy that research in neurobiology is actually aligned with what we're saying. So, because this is just a social theory, okay? So, in fact, we have little to say about the human brain. We assume that there's a human brain at work here, okay? So it's not like we're denying neurobiology. No, we assume that there is a human brain. We assume that there is memory. So memory is extremely important, okay? Because without memory, you cannot have an identity over time, right? And perhaps, you know, the tragic aspect of Alzheimer's, right, is that losing your memory, you really lose your identity, okay? So for us, identity is really something you construct over time. And then memory is very important, so the way the brain is organized is an essential. But we assume that, okay? And at that time, neurobiology was not so focused on interactions among humans. You know, there are now new theories that assume that the neocortex is actually a socially constructed system. That in fact, and I don't know, don't quote me on that because I'm not. But from what I read. People are saying that, in fact, the development of the human brain cannot be explained by survival alone. You need to understand social interactions, the complexity of social interactions that give you some advantages in reproduction by understanding the social system and being successful within the social system. So there are really interesting new theories that would actually be very, very well aligned with what we're doing. You know, but of course, this is the plug and play aspect of theories, that they need to interact with each other and see whether there is compatibility among them. And so, yeah, we're very happy about that. Yeah, no, because if, you know, if you think of the multiplicity of different theories contributing to a perspective, right, like human learning as a multiplicity of different dimensions, if our theory was really in total contradiction with something that neurobiologists were coming up with, that would be a real problem. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a different, but there are things that our theory is not good at saying, for instance, right? So for instance, if someone has a serious disability, right, or maybe an accident in their brain, our theory has no explanation for why they cannot become a member. You see what I mean? So we are not equipped to talk about that very well, except in the sense that, you know, that membership and identity is a dialectic process, right? So identity is something that you construct, but is also given by the context, right? So, you know, if you are never allowed to cut the fabric by the community, you may think, oh, I'm a good tailor, but unless the community agrees with you, you see what I mean? You're going to have a hard time asserting that identity, right? So, you know, but if you think of a dog in a family, right? Our theory would say, this dog should become a full member of the family. It's really peripherally, it's a peripheral participant, right? But our theory does not have enough to say about the brain of the dog, to say, no, that dog is not going to become a full member of the family, even though that dog spends a lot of time interacting with everybody, but they cannot engage with the language. There are all sorts of limitations. And the family may or may not give that dog full membership. You see what I mean? So it's a social process as well as a biological process. But certainly the biological process has a lot to do with it. Yeah. Yep. Okay, so after that, for me, I started to do for my PhD an ethnography in an insurance office in the U.S. And you don't have this here in Norway, but in the U.S., medical insurance is private, so if you go to your doctor, you need to send a claim to your insurance to pay the doctor or to reimburse you if you paid the doctor. It's a complicated system, but anyway, that's the way it is. And so I was working with people who process those claims to make sure that the insurance contract covers the kind of things that you are claiming and so on and so forth. And so what I discovered is that people working in that office had formed a kind of committee of practice, if you will, among themselves to help each other go through the day, you know. And so this was a different kind of community, because there it's a community that had been created to help each other learn how to deal with a shared context. You see what I mean? So here, you know, we were taking the community of practice for granted, you know, and assuming that learning was a trajectory into the community. Now, it was a bit different. It was people on different trajectories, kind of forming an alliance. And it was interesting that, from a perspective of identity, for those people in that office, belonging to that office was almost like a denied part of their identity. So a lot of their practice was, how can you survive the hours that you have to spend in that office and protect your identity so that at 5 o'clock you still have an identity to live with, you know? So it was an interesting practice, you know? So it's a practice of not giving the job too much. See what I mean? It was a practice of... And it was interesting because when I first started my ethnography, there I arrived in this office as a graduate student, you know, thinking that no ability was universal, you know, and... You know, and why don't you show some interest in your job? You know, I mean, like, because sometimes, you know, sometimes a customer would call and the customer would say, hey, I put a claim for $200 and I get $5, you know? What happened, you know? And of course, it's because, you are protected from that. Be grateful. But it's very complicated because they are deductible and co-pay, you have to pay a little part of the amount and so on and so forth, and up to a certain maximum, and after that the insurance pays fully and so on. It's very complicated. And these claim processes, you know, they were basically told, I went through the training, they were basically told, when you get a claim, you put this piece of data here, you put this piece of data there, you put this piece of data, and the computer does the calculation and tells you how much the person will get. You see what I mean? So their practice didn't give them very many tools for talking to the customer who doesn't care where the data go on which line. You see what I mean? They care about why is this fair in the big scheme of things, you know? And so my first interpretation was, whoa, these people have developed a practice of ignorance, you know? Because they don't care, you know? And over time, because I lived there for a year, you know, I really lived in that office to really understand what was going on. Over time, I had to also understand these people have developed a practice that is a very, not clever, but a very reasonable response to the way that they are treated. You don't care about me. I don't care about you. You pay me little. I give you little. See what I mean? So in some sense, they had developed a practice that was a very reasonable response, even though it made those phone calls a bit painful. Again, it was okay to go through that pain. You see what I mean? If you had a bad call with a customer, everybody understood. Nobody said, you should understand more about the insurance industry, you know? Nobody said that, you know? So it was interesting how the alliance that they had created had developed a definition of competence in that context, which to me, you see what I mean? To me as an external intellectual was like incompetence, you know what I mean? But for them, it was competence. And I had, after living there for a year, to respect that it was competence. You know, they had developed a practice that was a competent response to their context. You see what I mean? But it was their definition of competence that mattered, you see. And actually, the people in that office who were starting to show interest in the company, and they were, because they wanted maybe to move into a managerial position, they had a little bit of an identity crisis, and there were tensions once you started to show too much interest in the job. So it was an interesting observation, you know, of what learning is about, what learning in practice is about, you know. Because they would tell you, you know, the worst thing that can happen to me is to think about work after 5. You know? That was what their practice was about, that at 5 o'clock you go home and you're free. You do what you care about then. You see what I mean? So it was interesting to see how that local definition of competence was functional for them. Now, a Marxist would tell you this is false consciousness, these people are exploited, and I completely agree that in some sense they're exploited, but what they're doing is that they're preserving themselves in that context, and they help each other. You see what I mean? They have really created a committee of practice to help each other. And they want, you see, they're not, they very few of them are hoping to stay in that office. For many of them, it's just a temporary trajectory, and they're hoping to move on. Many of them are students, and they do that to pay their schooling and so on and so forth. So it's a temporary alliance of creating a practice to survive that context and then move on at 5 o'clock, and also move on in their life trajectory somewhere else. You know, so it's a very different view of a committee of practice. All of a sudden, it's almost like, from a theoretical perspective, you're doing a figure ground shift, right? In the first version of the theory, you took the committee of practice for granted, and you theorized learning as a trajectory in. Here, we take social learning for granted, and we theorize communities of practice as kind of an emergent property of a learning partnership among people. See what I mean? So it's an interesting switch in the theory. And it doesn't mean that the first theory is wrong at all, because here the newcomers still get inducted into the practice. But the group is very actively involved in developing a practice that evolves over time. And you could still hear in that office comment from the old-timers about when the computer came, you know? When the computer came and transformed their practice completely, they had to completely reorganize their practice around a discontinuity in technology. So you can see how active a social process of negotiating competence was in that context. So something much more dynamic than was theorized in the first phase of the theory. It's a construction. It's a social definition of competence done by people who need to learn how to respond to their circumstances. And so the negotiation of meaning was then theorized as involving two different aspects. On the one hand, the participation, so the fact that people are involved personally, and also the product of that practice, or the way that this practice becomes embodied in certain artifacts. And so, because a learning theory has to have a theory of memory, you could say there was a sort of dual theory of memory from a social perspective in this context: the experience of people over time, which was their participation, and the artifacts that the community had produced to embody its practice, if you will. And you can see that as a social form of memories through time, these two aspects exist through time somewhat independently, even though they are both part of the negotiation of meaning, you know, they exist through time independently. So if you're an archaeologist and you dig for artifacts and you find a piece of pottery, in some sense it's the reification of a practice where the participation has long ago disappeared, but the artifact has survived, and in some sense the art of the archaeologist is to reconstruct the practice, a view of the practice in which that artifact would make sense. But you can see how those two things, the existence of people and the existence of artifacts, even though they are both part of the same process of creating a practice, exist through time and space in somewhat independent ways, mm-hmm. which creates a dynamic, because then an artifact can move from one practice to another. People can also move from one practice to another, leave their artifacts behind. So it's a very dynamic view of how social learning is taking place. But this notion of a horizontal system then, I think, became important in the way that the theory was viewed. Okay? So this idea that we had a learning theory that was moving from the notion of a provider of knowledge to a recipient of knowledge to the notion of a learning partnership then made this theory interesting for people who were interested in learning in different contexts, you know? Because in some sense, what we were theorizing there is that you had a tension between the negotiation of competence by a community and the experience of members. And each new member would kind of potentially bring a new dimension. So you could see that, and actually if you think of, even if you're a PhD student, right, first of all, we ask you to recognize our community. So for me, if I read a dissertation, the first thing I want to know is, does this person understand my community? Do they understand where we are, what we've done, what we've learned? You know, that's the first thing. And that's why in many PhD programs, we ask you to do a review, right, to review the literature, because we want to understand that, we want to make sure that you understand the history of our community well enough to participate in it. Okay? But then I think we also ask you to bring in something new, to bring in a new experience, a new dimension. You know, so we ask you to, at least for me, when I read the decision again, I think, is this person telling me something that makes a difference to my understanding of the world? Is this person contributing to the competence of my community in such a way that it does, that it changes the competence of my community? And I think that's the most difficult part of a PhD, is to understand, where can I do a little something that's going to be recognized by the member of this community as making a difference, pushing the competence a little further? So the competence of a community is not fixed. People can bring new experiences, but you have to negotiate that what you bring is recognized as a contribution by the members. So there is this tension. So you could see that we are theorizing learning now in two directions. In the second phase, learning is not simply entering a community. Learning is also moving that community along. Okay, so bringing something new, like this in the office, there was a person who started to bring candies, you know, and so she brought something new into the community by saying, okay, if we can bring some candy and share some candy, we can avoid, they call it the blues, you know, when you get the blues, because it's, you know, sometimes it's boring, you know, to be in the office. So a bit of candy helps, you know, make the thing bearable. But you see what I mean? There was a contribution. She had understood the competence of the community, and she had found a way to contribute to it in a way that didn't exist before. You see what I mean? So that's, I'm not saying that's the equivalent of a PhD. but it's a little something like that. Is that, so in this field of the theory, a community of practice is not static at all. It is constantly an interaction between competence and experience, and sometimes it's one that pulls the other, as in apprenticeships, it's the competence that pulls the experience until you are a full member. But sometimes it's the experience that pulls the competence by members contributing something from their own experience, maybe somewhere else, you know, outside of the practice or the experience of an activity and so on and so forth, and sort of negotiating that experience into the competence of the community and therefore changing the competence of the community. So you could think from this perspective, in this second phase of theory, of a community of practice as a kind of a little hill of competence, a little definition of it's an unstable equilibrium between multiple claims to competence. Okay? And by claims to competence, I mean like if you are a PhD student, you make a claim to competence. You make a claim to competence by showing that you understand the competence of the community. And that claim can be refused. You know? Your PhD committee can say, you have a claim to competence, but really, we personally think that you should, you know, get a job in a restaurant. You know? See what I mean? So, a claim to competence can always be refused or accepted by the community, whether it's a claim to an existing competence or whether it's a claim to a new dimension of the competence that you bring in, which has to be also negotiated with the community. So this is the way that we think about learning in this phase of the theory. And, Anton wanted me to talk about professional development. What is interesting from a professional development perspective, because he's studying the professions, you know, is that in some sense, in a community of practice, what we have is that we have the parallel development of the practice and the identity. And I think that's important, is that you view professional development here as both developing professionals and developing the practice. And in a community of practice, you develop yourself as a professional by contributing to the development of the practice. Yeah? And my experience, for instance, with teacher professional development, right, is that when teachers are involved in the negotiation of what good teaching is, there's something different that happens than if they are involved simply in complying with certain curricular requirements. So I would say that if you think of, you know, developing a community of practice for teachers, or for any profession, but I give the example of teachers because I think there's a teacher preparation school in this institution. So I'm taking this example, but you could think of many different examples. Is that there is something about your professional identity that changes when your professional identity is engaged in negotiating what competence is, than if your professional identity is negotiating in complying with demands that are where the definition of competence is outside of your ability to engage. I don't know if this makes sense, but I think it's an important distinction, and what form it takes, you know, that you can think of different ways that this could be implemented. It could even be implemented within a school. I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is that a crucial difference between a course where the competence is defined in a curriculum that is then imparted and a community of practice is that in a community of practice you become involved personally in the negotiation of what counts as competence, you know, in your context. Yeah? In the same way that these claims processes were involved in defining the competence in that context. In that case of the claim processor, it just happened. It's a case I know well because I did my ethnography there. Of course, their competence was to some extent against the design of the job. Okay, so they they were protecting themselves from the design of the job. It doesn't have to be that way, you know. So we have seen since then committees of practice in other contexts where, you know, a bunch of engineers really want to design good cars. And the company wants to design good cars too. So it's not necessarily the community against the institution. I'm not saying that. It's just in that case it was a little bit because of the way they were treated, you know. But this idea that you are involved in both processes at once, that, you know, going to a meeting of your engineering community and solving the problem of one of your engineers and finding a new way to solve that design challenge is also professional development. You see what I mean? Because it's all engaging your identity in pushing the profession further. That's what I'm trying to say here, by identity and practice being two dimensions of the learning that happens together. And then something happened in that phase two of the theory, is that lots of organizations said, "Huh, that's interesting. Most of our learning happens in training, formally. Are you telling us that in fact, in our organization, there are probably communities and networks of people who develop the competence together to do the job that they're supposed to do?" That's an interesting way of thinking about knowledge existing in an organization. See what I mean? So at the time, the field of knowledge, of so-called knowledge management in the world of business was very much in crisis. People had thought, because the field of knowledge management studied in IT departments, and people had very much thought that the way to manage knowledge is to codify the knowledge into a computer system, give everybody access to that computer system, and then people would have managed the knowledge of the organization. So this was a different way of thinking about the problem of knowledge in organization that a number of managers recognized as, yeah, this is actually more aligned with the way things happen in my organization. And this is why these big Lotus Node databases, for those of you who are old enough to know what a Lotus Node database, but these big Lotus Node database, knowledge bases, you know, that we had come, are not functioning very well, you know, because people call each other when they have a problem. They don't necessarily go to the, and at the time, search engines were not very good. So anyway, lots of explanation for why historically the concept of committee of practice and that perspective on learning, which we thought we were building for education, was actually first adopted in business, you know. And in business, what happened is that because managers are not theorists, they are not happy to just, oh, this is an interesting perspective on how knowledge exists in our organization. There must be some communities and networks that are hidden, that are not in the org chart, you know. They say, what can we do? You know, if this is where the knowledge of the organization exists, can we do something? You know? And so the concept of committee of practice then moved from a theoretical concept, which was an observational, analytical concept in its first version, to an instrumental concept. You know, this committee of practice are good. I want some, you know. Can we? How much is it going to cost? And can we do this by Christmas? You see what I mean? So, a very different view. And for me, at first, I was a bit uncomfortable with that, you know, because I was thinking, no, but those things have a life of their own, you know. But I have had to admit that some organizations have actually taken this approach and have created a context, more or less successfully, not all successfully, but have created a context in which these communities can actually become part of the organization, you know, become part of how people understand their work. So, you know, in some of these organizations, it would not be unusual if you go to your manager and you propose an idea, it would not be unusual for your manager to say, have you talked to your committee of practice about this? And what do they think? See what I mean? So it is interesting how the notion of a committee of practice has now become, in some organizations, integrated into the way that you are a professional. So you belong to a team where you accomplish a certain task, but at the same time you belong to a committee of practice of peers where you discuss issues and you solve problems together, you maybe read papers together to take the research into your practice and so on and so forth. So that was a surprising development for us. But an interesting one, and you can see that there are private organizations here. There are governmental organizations where for them, the Center for Disease Control, the nice thing about a committee of practice is that it doesn't depend on where you live. If you live in a small government, if you live in a research center, if you live in a federal government, so you can belong to a committee of practice from wherever you are. So it's a way to cut across the silos of different organizations and to create conversations that cut across the system, you know. And so what that added to our work is there an art of cultivating communities of practice? And, you know, we have only an hour and a half or something, so we're not going to go into that very deeply, but it became an important part of our work to start thinking about, okay, you know, we know a lot about managing teams and so on and so forth. If developing committees of practice becomes an important way to manage the knowledge of an organization, then what about those people who take a role in enabling that process? Yeah? And you can see that there are a number of things that have come to the surface as an important part of that. Understanding leadership role, understanding a learning agenda, and in some sense these communities formally or informally manage what they need to learn. So one way to think about a committee of practice is it's also putting the learning in the hands of the people who have to use the knowledge in their practice. Okay? So this idea of that a committee of practice drives a learning agenda becomes an interesting managerial or pedagogical question, right? Because traditionally the learning agenda is driven by a professor or a teacher or an expert or something like this. And here we have, in some sense, the curriculum is the practice. The practice is the driving force behind the learning. And I don't want to go into all the detail, but these are interesting questions that we are struggling with now to understand, you know, how do you ensure continuity over time, you know, so that a community keeps learning and remembering, you know. These are all sorts of question that come with this view of learning. Also finding a voice, you know, some communities, one of the value of being a community is that you find a collective voice to bring the perspective of practice into policy discussions, into training and so on and so forth. So this idea that there is a collective voice of practice. Actually, we are working with a project about learning disability in the U.S., where an important dimension of the project is to bring policymakers and practitioners into conversation, so that the voice of practice can actually become an active element of the process of policy development. You know. And actually, this leads now to what I would call the third phase of our theory, where precisely the question of learning and the question of developing practice becomes one where there's more than one practice involved. And because, you know, 10, 15 years ago, when we asked to help develop learning in an organization, we were very much saying, you know, you have engineers in London, in Tokyo, and in New York, and they don't talk to each other. Shouldn't they talk to each other? See what I mean? It was more like building community of practice among obvious learning partners who should talk to each other. But when I was telling you about this project between policymakers and practitioners, it's a different question of practice. It's a question of how does your practice function within a broader system of practices? And do you enable the learning at the level of the landscape of those practices as opposed to just your own? I don't know if this makes sense. But so this is an example of a community that was actually started by a collaborative of funders in the field of accountability and transparency. So in that field, people do things like put the budget of a government online. Okay, the idea being that if citizens have access to information about how the government is using public funds, they will hold their government accountable to using that money for providing services as opposed to buying villas in the Caribbean or whatever. You see what I mean? But that field has been going on for many years. Different organizations are funding different projects. But these funders had the feeling that the field was not structured well enough to learn about how to be effective. You know, they were not even sure that they had made all that much difference in the real life of citizens, especially in the developing world. And so the idea there was to bring a committee of practice together with funders, civil society organizations who do these kind of projects, and academics who are often hired by the funders to do an evaluation of a project to make sure that that project is actually done what the funding contract was saying. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's a very standard situation in the world of development, international development. And so the idea of this community was to bring these different practices into an interaction and to really, again, inspect practice. So it was really still about practice. Develop, if possible, new practices of funding that would include learning into the process. So it was an interesting community. It is still an interesting community. It is still a community that's very complex. It's not clear that it's going to survive as a community because it's kind of like it's at the boundary between practices, you know. And so it's asking people to go outside of their practice in some sense to understand the relationship of their practice to the rest of the landscape. It's demanding a lot, you know. The fact that it is started by funders is actually probably the only reason it's surviving up to now, you know, to be fair, you know, because it gives it a lot of legitimacy if you are the you know, the big foundations and so on and so forth. So in that case, what you have is that you have different practices that where there is a missed learning opportunity, and the idea is to bring them closer together into something that is still like a committee of practice because it talks about practice, but where there are lots of boundaries to negotiate. Why should I spend my time with you? You know? So it's a little easier, you know, if you are both teachers, to say, well, we should spend time together because I think we'd become better teacher if we spend time together. It's a bit easier than to ask people from different places in the landscape to start engaging with each other to see the effect of their practice on the broader, on the learning capability of the broader landscape. So in this third phase of the theory, it's again a kind of figure ground shift. In the second phase, the focus was still very much on one community at a time and the art of cultivating a community. Here the focus is very much on more like a landscape of different practices, and the learning potential exists not in any given community, but in the relationship among these practices, and sometimes in the boundaries between those practices. So all of a sudden, what becomes salient is both the definition of competence in different practices and the boundary between them, and in some sense increasing the learning potential is reconfiguring that landscape, such that maybe there's a little bridge between two hills, or there's a new hill starting somewhere, you know. So think of the metaphor of a landscape allowing you to say, okay, in the terrain of knowing, different communities have colonized different parts of that landscape, and they have claimed, if you want to be an actor here, you need to be competent according to our definition of competence. You see what I mean? So you can have some hills that are very steep, you know, you can have some hills that are not very steep. You know, a cousin of mine, I often give that example because it's interesting. He was a particle physicist, and he told me there are 10 people in the world who understand what I'm doing. Now, you know, in the landscape of practice, that's a little needle, you know, very high, very narrow, you know, 10 people, you know. It takes your whole dedication of your whole life to stay on that hill, you know. And it's not clear that people on that hill are very good at communicating with the rest of us, you know, because, you know, there are only 10 people who understand what they're doing. So it's a demonstration of how certain communities, and, you know, they have colonized that region of the landscape successfully. They must be able to speak to funders, you know, like the National Science Foundation, and so on, well enough that, you know, their work is being funded. So it's interesting, but it's a hill where there's a lot of climbing if you want to be a full member. So for us, this notion of that learning potential has to take the landscape into account as opposed to certain communities. So I think that in this third field of theory, I would say that our focus is more on learning capability. What are the dimensions of social learning capability as opposed to let's build communities? It's also recognizing that some communities, in colonizing a part of the landscape, may decrease the learning potential. So the success of a community may decrease the learning potential across the landscape through its success. And that's very much actually what this the idea of this community of practice on transparency and accountability is about, is that some foundations have become so good at creating good requests for proposal, evaluating the proposals that come in, creating contracts about how to use that money, and then hiring academics to make sure that that contract has been fulfilled. They've become so good at this that the learning of the field is almost grind to a halt, because if you are a small civil society organization and you have a good grant from the Ford Foundation and what you did completely flopped, right? You're not going to go back and tell them, yeah, no, that was a disaster. You're going to make sure that the evaluation fulfills the requirements of the contract, so you'll get the next, because you have employees, right, who have families. You don't want to go out of business, right? So that idea that you've become so good at doing sort of like, sort of result-based evaluation and result-based funding and so on and so forth, that the effect on the whole landscape is bringing the field to a grinding halt from the point of view of social learning. You know. Oh, I promised that I was going to pause a little bit, and I didn't pause after phase two. So, feel free to interrupt me, okay? If I forget to pause, I get too much into what I'm saying. You know, so you know, feel free to interrupt. I'm just trying to engage you with the sense of what we're trying to do here. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. In the last picture, you showed a circle of people. Do you have a comment to the circle?
So this is actually my wife who's helping facilitating this community.
Is she a circle convener?
Well, we were helping this collaborative of funders bring together these different people. So this is actually in Cape Town in South Africa. And these people have come from different places of the world. They are players in that field. And so the fact that they are in a circle is one activity, you know, where they were discussing one shared problem together. Sometimes we put people at tables. So, yeah, this just happens to be one picture I have of our work with that community, okay? The activities we design have very different format depending on. So what was interesting about that meeting that we've learned is how important it is when you bring people together across difficult boundaries, how important it is to give them time across boundaries, but also time within the boundaries to digest, if you will, within their own community how what they are talking about with others influence what they're doing. So in that case, we had to really find different activities that allowed moments of cross-boundary interactions, moments of reflection on their own practice, and so on and so forth. Yeah. So this is a moment where they were all together, you know, at the beginning of the meeting. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting for us to start thinking about, you know, the management of boundaries as an explicit part of the learning of any given community. You see what I mean? It brings a whole new dimension to what it means to function in a landscape. And So theoretically, I don't know. I'm going to try to do is to give you a little bit of a glimpse into the life of a theorist, because, and this is really work that I've been doing with Bev, my wife, but when the trainer part of my new name, Wenger Trainer, because, you know, from a theory perspective, the notion of community of practice had an elegance to it, you know, and maybe that's why it had a good career as a theory. Because, you know, in order to talk about learning and not just change, you have to assume that there is a better, right? There is a definition of better, right? What it means to improve, right? In a landscape, the gradient of a hill means you're getting there, right? We had a very elegant definition of that by saying, if you want to know if a person is learning, ask the community. See what I mean? We had a social location for the definition of learning. That was, a community, even if it's something new. You see what I mean? So even if as a PhD students, you produce a brand new theory, right, that is completely revolutionary for your field, it's still within the community that we ask the question, is this a good contribution? See what I mean? So, in the theory, by placing learning within the competence of given communities, we had a very elegant social theoretic way of thinking about learning, right? But if you now blow that up to landscape, you have a problem. theoretically, is that it is absolutely unrealistic to expect that the way to contribute to learning in the landscape is by becoming competent in all the practices of the landscape. Right? And no person can do that. So, how your learning is situated within the landscape requires a different relationship to competence than competence itself. I don't know if I'm making that clear, but this is, when you do a theory, that is earth-shaking, you know? All of a sudden, what was a source of elegance in your theory doesn't quite work. See what I mean? And so we have introduced recently, in a new book, this notion of knowledgeability. What we mean by knowledgeability is a relationship to a landscape that allows you to locate yourself and what you're doing in relationship to that landscape and does not require you to be competent. You see? So, you know, we had a votation in the US, right? I'm not a politician, but I feel that I have to become knowledgeable about politics so that I can vote intelligently. Didn't turn out that way, but it's another question. Although I think I voted intelligently, but anyway, it's another question. But you see what I mean? The problem theoretically that we have, and we are still working it out, we haven't really completely resolved that tension in the theory, is that if I say I'm knowledgeable about politics, where is this claim socially negotiated? You see? Before we say, oh, you go ask the committee of practice, is this a competent contribution? But if you lose that, you know, we know that the concept of knowledgeability is an important concept because really very much it's the situation we have in the 21st century, right? Is that we are competent in one or two practices and we have to be knowledgeable about many, right? So if you're a teacher, you have to be knowledgeable about research some, right? So that you can know what research says about your profession, but you don't become a researcher necessarily, or maybe you do a little bit. See what I mean? So you have to sort of see your relationship to many different practices, you know? And I think, you know, if we talk, okay, I'm going to expose myself here. If I talk to a French person and I say, oh, I'm very knowledgeable about politics, you know? And they say, do you know Sarkozy? Yeah. Do you know who the Prime Minister of Norway is? You know? No. I don't. Embarrassing, but true. I don't freak out, you know? If somebody asks me, do you know Obama? And I say, no. Are you knowledgeable about politics? You see what I mean? So the claim to be knowledgeable about politics functions in a much more complex way than a claim to competence in a given practice, you know? Because if you are a Norwegian, probably, not to know the name of the Prime Minister of Norway would probably disqualify you as a person who is knowledgeable about politics, right? You see what I mean? But how does that claim become, if I say I'm becoming more and more knowledgeable about politics, you know, how does that claim function from a social theoretical perspective is now something that we need to work out, you know. So I just wanted to show you how, what it means to be a theorist is to create a technical language of certain concepts that together form a perspective that is as elegant as possible in the kind of explanatory mechanism that it provides, you know. And I think we still, you see, competence is still very important, you know. So the fact that there is that hill of competence of particle physicists, 10 people who only understand each other, is very important for society. See, some people say, oh, you know, we are in the age of networks, you know, communities, you know, quaint, you know, that's the 19th century. No, it's still very important to have a community of people who are committed to understanding a problem and, you know, engage their identity strongly in working that out. This is not going to disappear. On the contrary, we have intense specialization, you know. The field of knowing is getting extremely fragmented and diverse. This is still going to be an important the negotiation of competence and the creation of hills is going to be very important, you know. So this has not disappeared, but this notion of knowledgeability then, you know, opens a whole new dimension to a social perspective on learning, you know. Because, you know, some people may say, yeah, okay, good, you've come back home, thank you. You know, because what we do in schooling is to give knowledgeability. We don't give competence, you know. So, thank you for coming back, you know, now you're good with us, you know. So, so we would say, well, yes. But knowledgeability is a relationship to a landscape. It's not a relationship to a curriculum. So the notion of identity is still very central. So from the point of view of professional development, for instance, if the goal of becoming a professional is to become a good citizen of a landscape, you know, that's a bit different from acquiring a seamless curriculum. Because, you know, that's in the last. If you think of this person, a nurse, perhaps, you know, right? And you think of his practice, right? In his professional trajectory, he's gone through different places, you know, he's gone through the Oslo Community College, you know, program, you know, and you are that his teacher, and as his teachers, you probably hope that what you teach is going to have some effect on his practice. You know, you may be deluded, or not, I don't know, but, you know, there's the hope that the training will have some, but there are other places in the landscape that also hope to have some influence on his practice. There are people doing research, in different discipline, there are regulatory bodies that define a curriculum or that define certain competencies for nursing and so on and so forth. There's the workplace, you know, there's a boss who says, you know, we need to save money or we need to improve this quality measure or whatever. There is colleagues, you know, who are also debating whether this is a good idea or not, and then even the clients that may have an opinion, whether it's the parents of a kid or a patient. And so, in that landscape, there are all sorts of relationship between those practices that may be collaborative or there may be disagreement. Okay, so in some sense, if you are a teacher or a nurse or whatever, and you are with a client, with a patient or with a student, what you have to do as a professional is that you have to take this whole landscape and translate it into a moment of service to a person. It's an amazing, if you think of a professional from this perspective, it's an amazing view, you know, because it's incredible. You know, like if you, should I give you this test or not, right? Well, in training they said, yeah, give the test. But research says, you know, these tests, we don't know. They have a lot of false positive, you know? Oh, I don't know. The professional body says, you know, you have to be ethical, you have to serve the customer. But your boss says, you have to serve the budget of this institution, you know, save money as much as you can. These tests are very expensive, okay? See what I'm saying? And it's still in that whole landscape, it's still you as a professional, you have to say, okay, where do I invest my sense of accountability? You know what I mean? And, you know, what I'm showing here is that the landscape is not becoming simpler, it's becoming more complicated. You know? There are new entrants into, at least in the gray, those were recognized institutions that were accountable to some kind of institutional charter, but there are all sorts of new entities joining the fray here, which may or may not be under institutional scrutiny, you know. Some, like Wikipedia, are under public scrutiny. In some sense, Wikipedia is committee of practice on steroids. You know what I mean? It's like, but it's like, this article is viewed as knowledge when it doesn't change anymore, right? Because if everybody can change it, when it stops changing, it must represent some kind of collective agreement. You know, it's an interesting collectivization. It's almost like that's what happened in the Renaissance, right? Where the production of knowledge moved from an individual process as an alchemist to transform lead into gold to a collective process of you make a statement of truth, the community debates it, and over time we produce knowledge, right? So this is what we are moving towards, I think, you know, a very complex landscape in which to negotiate who you are. So from the point of view of knowledgeability, what is interesting from a theoretical perspective is that the burden of knowledgeability is shifting a bit from the community to the person. Now, I want to make sure I say that clearly. We are not saying, from this theory's perspective, that we are moving from a collective society to an individual society. You know, as I said, my cousin could not be a particle physicist if he did not belong to a community of people who are developing that competence. Very important. You cannot be a scientist without a community. Okay? So, you know, it's not moving from collective to individual. But the shift of the burden of what it means to be knowledgeable is a shift towards a more individualized claim. You see what I mean? So if you live... If being knowledgeable is simply competence in a community, in some sense the community is doing a lot of the work for you. As long as you comply with that community, you are competent. You see what I mean? You don't have to negotiate a whole lot yourself except to be recognized as competent by that community. You know? But if that relationship to the landscape becomes important, there's a shift towards the person. You know? There's a shift for that profession to decide, do I give the test or not? It could be, in some cases, a relatively lonely decision because there are so many places to choose from. You know? And so, in some sense, we could view the 21st century as, from a learning theory, social learning theory's perspective, as a time where there is a shift in the burden of knowledgeability from the community to the person. Because of the complex landscape in which we define who we are and in which we have notions of relationships of accountability. So I wanted to leave you with this idea of your life as a trajectory through that landscape, entering and coming out of communities, ignoring some communities, feeling you have to be knowledgeable about others, and so on and so forth. If you think of your own journey through that landscape, it's a very complex way of thinking about how do you develop an identity that is workable, you know, for you and for your context. And, you know, it is not surprising, if this is true about the 21st century, it is not surprising also that you have fundamentalist movements where, you know, you can easily find a clear, simple identity, you know. So, you know, but I think as institutions we have to embrace, I think, as institutions of learning, we have to embrace this complexity of the 21st century and see how can we help our students find their place in the landscape, find enough competence to be anchored, and find enough knowledgeability to be meaningfully located. Okay, thank you. So.